Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here on the 18th floor at 303 Wacker. Here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we'll do the Monday morning movie reviews. They're just coming up in just a couple of seconds here, and much more. We're going to talk about customer complaints and lots more stuff here on the show at 312-981-7200 for talk or text, 312-981-7200. All right. It is Monday, and that means that Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me to review all the new movies and talk box office as well. Lots of movies to talk about this weekend. And let's get the guys back for our Monday morning movie reviews. And here is Eric. Welcome back.
Hello.
Hello, Eric.
Hello.
Colin. Hello, Colin.
Hello there.
All right. Welcome back, guys. Get to the movie reviews. Let's see. Where are we going to start here? Why don't we start, Colin? Why don't you tell us about Custody?
All right. Well, this is a domestic drama that has an interesting backstory, but I'll get to that in a minute. And as the title probably implies, this is a film about a custody battle between two parents as they vie for custody of their 11-year-old son. And they have an 18-year-old daughter, but because she's 18 and moving out, she doesn't have as much at stake in this, according to the judge. And the film opens with the two parents at a custody hearing where we learn, who wants what, and including the kid. And the kid, whose name is Julian, doesn't want to see his father anymore. And he doesn't want to hear from him, and he doesn't want him anywhere near his mother either. Because this is not a good guy, and but the courts rule that he gets to take Julian on weekends anyway, and so we see them on their weekends together, and it's anything but cordial. The kid is scared to death of his dad and resents him, and the dad knows that he isn't being told everything about where the mother really lives and what their lives are really like. And so this movie is about how this dad just manipulates and deceives and uses this kid to get what he wants. And so this is a pretty tough movie, but it's incredibly compelling too. It's directed by a guy named Xavier Legrand, and I said this thing had an interesting backstory. Well, it's actually a sequel to a short film that was made a few years ago that was nominated for Best Short Film, and if my memory serves, it was the film I was rooting for that year. It was a film called Just Before Losing Everything, and I'm pretty sure it was the best of the five, but because they're not speaking English, it didn't win. And it also actually stars the same two people who played the parents in that movie. But you don't have to have seen that movie to, get that this is a sequel to it or to know what's going on. It's an incredibly compelling film nonetheless. One that I rank up there with Kramer versus Kramer and Shoot the Moon as like the best movies about divorce.
Wow.
And custody hearings and who gets to get the kid and everything. I mean, I really do think it's that good.
Wow. Bringing up Shoot the Moon, man. That's,
oh, I mean, this is, I mean, this movie has that kind of intensity. Think of Albert Finney's most intense scenes in that movie. And this movie is filled with those kinds of scenes that are just as well acted. The kid in this movie is fantastic. The kid who plays Julian, is just amazing. He's got to do all these really tough, long takes where he's just emoting and not saying anything, and you really feel for this kid. I mean, it's just so hard to watch sometimes. I think this is one of the best films of the year. It's playing at the Music Box right now, and this guy Xavier Legrand, I think he's a great talent. I'm glad that he's following through on, after making such a great short film, that he's following through and making something just as good.
Okay, all right, that's Custody. High praise from Colin. I mean, because Colin, anytime you mention Shoot the Moon, you're mentioning one of my favorite movies ever made.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, let's see. Eric, why don't you tell us about Papillon?
Okay, well, this is a remake of 1973 film. I believe that's the year the original came out, with Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman. It's based on a true story of a safecracker who was sent to a really horrific penal colony, and chronicles his attempts to not just survive in that penal colony, but also his attempts to escape. He meets the Papillon in this film is played by I always get him confused with Garrett Hedlund. Every time.
Yeah.
Every single time one of them in a movie, I get them confused with the other one, yes. So Charlie Hunnam plays Papillon in this film, and as he meets in the original film, he finds a guy, a rich cellmate. The original is played by Dustin Hoffman, and this one is played by Rami Malek. And he's a much weaker guy, obviously. He's a money guy. He's, you know, gotten by his through his life through swindling and being rich, and now kind of needs a protector. And Papillon certainly fits that bill, but is doing so obviously with selfish intent to get him to help finance, if you will, any escape attempt that he goes through. So this leads to an extended section of the story where Papillon is basically put into solitary confinement for a good long time, and his ability to survive through that, and then takes you through basically a lot of the same beats that that you've come to expect if you remember, have a great knowledge of the original film, and so I went back before I saw this one. I hadn't seen the original movie in a long time, and what struck me watching the original again is that it's really a long film. I mean, it's a 2.5 hour film, and the section where he's in solitary confinement, you do really sort of feel that time along with him, and it bogs the film down a bit. This one, it tightens it up a little bit. It's still a film well over 2 hours. Charlie Hunnam, I think, is doing his best to fill Steve McQueen's shoes, although that's quite a task for any actor. Rami Malek certainly does a much better job filling in Dustin Hoffman's shoes, as he seems to almost be doing an impression of him throughout the time. And every time he's on screen, all I kept thinking about was how much I can't wait to see Bohemian Rhapsody and hope that they don't screw that up. I think that if you're a big fan of the original film, you're not going to find a whole lot here you need to see this one. I think that if you haven't seen the original film, this one will play a little bit better. But once you then see the original film, you kind of go, why do they need to remake this movie in the first place if they're just basically going to tell the same story with, there's a little extra brutality because, it is an R-rated film, but I think the original was R-rated as well, and was pretty violent for its time as well. So there's not a whole lot much more to add to this one. It's interesting to watch the performances. It's beautifully shot. But other than that, just watch the original and you'll be fine.
Okay, that's exactly what I thought would be the review.
Yeah.
So, all right, well, there you go. There's Papillon, which did not even make the top 10.
No.
At the box office. So, okay, all right. All right, Colin, why don't you tell us about The Wife?
All right, well, this stars Jonathan Pryce and Glenn Close as a couple who have been married for decades, and he's a celebrated writer who is about to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. And he gets the phone call at the beginning of the film, and he and his wife celebrate, and they head to Stockholm to attend the big event. They have to spend a few days there. And they bring their older son, played by Max Irons, with them. And he himself is a struggling writer, struggling more to win the approval of his father, who has always been critical of his son's work.
And, you know, the son has, of course, a lot to live up to now that his dad is winning the Nobel Prize. And so they get to Stockholm, and Jonathan Pryce's wandering eye wanders a little too often every time an attractive co-ed walks by, which Glenn Close notices every single time, because this has been a problem in the past. And naturally, this causes tension between them, and the movie flashes back to when they were younger and first met in a class that he taught, where she was a student, an aspiring writer in her own right. And actually, the woman who plays Glenn Close in the flashbacks is Annie Stark, who is Glenn Close's real-life daughter. So, you know, more tensions ensue as the week goes on, and their marriage is put to the test. Christian Slater is also in this as a biographer who has been wanting to write a biography on Jonathan Pryce's character for a long time now, and he may or may not be intentionally following them to Stockholm and you know, stalking them, let's just say. So I mean, you got a pretty strong cast here, and it really goes a long way towards making this movie recommendable. Really, this is, you know, Jonathan Pryce and Glenn Close, I think, are great choices to play these roles, because they really sell. I mean, they really come off as a couple who have been together a really long time, and who, you know how each other, you know, they can finish each other's sentences, and they're in that kind of relationship where they just, you know, they're bickering one minute, laughing the next minute, and then just having a big argument, you know, the minute after that. And all with this kind of natural flow to it, be like as if they really know these characters inside and out. You know, I mean, the story is pretty predictable. It's it's not hard to see where any of this is going to go. Some of the big revelations aren't exactly big, but you know, or they're kind of easy to figure out. But what really does sell this thing is especially Glenn Close. I mean, you know, she is doing some of the best acting in this that she's done in a long time without saying a word. You can just kind of feel her seething in so many moments in this film, and you just realize what a strong, you know, presence she is in everything she's in. But when she's in something, you know, that really, you know, allows her to, you know, just play to her strengths, as this movie does, you know, just realize what a great, great talent she's always been. A movie I recommend for the performances, a lot of strong scenes in it. It's not a great script, but it's a great vehicle. I mean, it's a good enough vehicle for these two actors to do some really strong work. So I'm recommending it mostly based on that.
Okay. All right. And that's The Wife with Glenn Close and Jonathan Pryce. And it's playing at the River East, the Landmark Century, and Evanston, if you want to check it out. Okay, guys, hang on, all right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Colin are going to hold on. We're going to take a break for the news, and then after the news, we'll come back with more movie reviews. It is the Monday Morning Movie Reviews right here on 720 WGN. We'll break for the news coming up next. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here, and we'll be here until 5 a.m. right here on 720 WGN. And, it's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. And we'll have a lot more stuff to talk about during the morning here. 312-981-7200 is your talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show, but the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every week to talk about the new movies. We'll review the new movies, and then Eric and I will talk about the box office as well. Let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. Eric, tell us about Support the Girls.
Okay, Support the Girls is a film premiered at South by Southwest and then premiered here in Chicago at our film festival, Chicago Critics Film Festival. And it's the latest film from Andrew Bajalski, who did Computer Chess and Results with Kobe Smulders and Guy Pearce a few years ago. And this story takes place at, you'll spend kind of a sports bar, kind of a Hooters-like sports bar. All the waitresses wear little skimpy outfits. And it's headed up by Regina Hall, who basically the movie takes place over the course of one day as she is trying to sort of keep everything together at the bar. You know, the girls there really like her, and she, you know, she does her best to help them out. James LeGros plays the owner of the establishment, and a lot of weird, quirky things go on throughout the day. Her lead waitress, one of the most enthusiasm, certainly, is played by the fantastic Haley Lou Richardson. And you know, and that's basically, you know, it's a day in the life, it's a story of, you know, about women and you know, the women empowerment and the rapport that these women have, and you know, kind of a, you know, a perfect film for you know, the times that we're currently living in. And Regina Hall, who I don't know has ever been better in a movie. She's been good in a lot of things, but this is a film that she really gets to anchor, and I think she's terrific in it. I cannot say enough about Haley Lou Richardson, who I think is, every time I see her in a movie now, I just think that she is just one big star turn away from becoming like the next big new thing. I mean, if people haven't seen Columbus, you know, Columbus, I think she gave one of the best performances of last year in that movie. And here it's a complete 180, doing a complete peppy comic performance that is just absolutely wonderful. She's amazing. It's a fun movie. It's a funny movie. You know, it's definitely serious at times, but it has a nice balance between the two. It's a good film that just kind of snuck back into theaters here in Chicago this past week, and people should take the opportunity to see it.
Yeah, I couldn't get to see it because it's playing in the weirdest theaters.
Yeah.
Very difficult to get. Well, for me, you know, very difficult to get to without, you know, taking nine different modes of transportation.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't get a chance to see it. I really want to see this movie. I hope it opens up at other theaters.
It's not playing on demand anywhere?
No, I didn't. I guess
no.
No?
It's a Magnolia release. I thought maybe it might be.
I did not check on the on demand. I did make an unfortunate purchase on demand, but we'll get to that in a little bit. But yeah, so I'm really, and Colin, you didn't see this one?
I did. I haven't seen it since our festival, and I didn't put my name next to it because we had so much to review tonight. But I did remember enjoying the movie. I kind of want to see it again before really giving a full review of it.
Okay.
But I think I echo everything Eric said. So,
all right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm really looking forward to it. And that's all. So I hope I get a chance to see it soon. All right. Colin, why don't you tell us about Axel?
Yeah, well, I did see this. Sometimes you got to take a bullet.
Yeah.
And this week I took Axel. So this is yet another dog movie for August. And in this one, a teenager named Miles has an accident on his motorbike in a middle-of-nowhere junkyard in California. Really not an accident, just a bunch of dirt bike rivals being D-bags to him and, you know, causing him to wipe out. Anyway, when he's there, he sees something rummaging around, and it turns out to be a mechanical war dog that has escaped from its laboratory. And the dog chases the kid through the junkyard. When it gets injured, the boy fixes the dog, and the bond ensues. So meanwhile,
I'm sorry. Hold on a second. I'm looking at the cast. Thomas Jane is in this?
Thomas Jane plays the kid's dad.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so how far he has
fallen. Oh, man. All right.
And, yeah, I know. The scientists who created this dog
are under orders from the military to find it and bring it back. So they send out 1,000 drone cameras. And meanwhile, this teenager and his love interest, played by Becky G, if you know who that is, a pop star, I think, they try to figure out what to do with this dog, who to tell about it, where to hide it. And while the scientists monitor how the dog is interacting with people and following human commands, while also this thing also, you know, will project cool DJ lighting effects during romantic moments, because that's one of the things this military war dog is programmed to do for some reason. Yeah, this is a pretty dumb movie, and one of the things that sort of encapsulates just the poor writing here. You know, every one of these kinds of movies, whenever the kid or whoever encounters an alien or some kind of being that doesn't speak English, but eventually learns a few phrases, and you know, that become important later on. You know, like E.T. says, "I'll be right here," and Iron Giant says, "I am not a gun." Well, this dog only learns to say one phrase, and it's "Yo, send it." That's it. Yeah, what does that mean? Well, it doesn't matter what it means. It's something the kid says at one point before doing a stupid stunt, and that's what the dog picks up on, and that's what he learns, and that's it. You kind of need more than that. You kind of need more than "yo, send it" to make kind of an emotional impact on the audience in any way. It also helps if the kid who's finding this thing expresses some, you know, moment of wonder and awe of what he's looking at. I mean, it's a mechanical dog. This is a pretty extraordinary find, but this kid like just can't, just sees it as, you know, just like, "Oh, that's weird." You know, and it's just, that's the kind of movie it is. It aspires to be, you know, that kind of Iron Giant kind of movie, only, you know, live action. But instead, it just reminded me of Monster Trucks from a couple years ago. That's not a good thing. And so there's a reason they didn't screen this movie for critics. It's because it's a dumb movie. And, that's why they're releasing it at the end of August, you know, when no one's paying attention. So you don't need to pay attention either. There's, I certainly say go see Alpha instead if you want to see a good, you know, boy and his dog movie. And we weren't even high on that movie last week, but after seeing this, I was like, well, maybe I should evaluate Alpha. Maybe that's a better movie than I'm giving it credit for. Certainly better than this. So yeah, you can skip this one.
Okay. all right. Well, there you go. That's Axel and starring Thomas Jane. All right,
oh, man.
Eric, tell us about Arizona.
Okay, well, this is a film that premiered at the midnight section of Sundance this year, and it's set during the housing crisis about a decade ago in an Arizona housing community. Rosemary DeWitt plays a real estate agent who is part of the group that is selling these units. Her boss is played by Seth Rogen, and one day at work, while Seth Rogen playing as sexist a boss as you can imagine, is having a conversation with one of their clients, played by Nick's second favorite actor, Danny McBride. Him and Seth Rogen's character get into an argument, and he ends up killing him. Danny McBride's character is, you know, just kind of desperate to try to keep a lid on this. He claims it was an accident, although there is clearly anger involved, and Rosemary DeWitt is a witness to it. And it just turns into basically a kidnapping and chase film. He kidnaps DeWitt's character and tries to keep her from, you know, spilling the beans on what just happened, but the more he tries to keep a lid on things, the more people he ends up murdering. It becomes, you know, in some respect, kind of a one-joke movie where just everyone that, you know, possibly, you know, catches wind of what's going on, he ends up killing in one way or another, as Rosemary DeWitt tries to escape and keep her, even her daughter, safe while they are chased through this community by this psychopath. So, you know, it sounds like a horror movie. It also could be a satire. And for me, I mean, it doesn't really work as a satire, and that's probably, you know, an understatement. You know, this is certainly not The Big Short by any stretch of the imagination, but as someone who, I guess, can be a Danny McBride apologist at times, I found a lot of amusement in just the manner in which he just keeps killing people. There was just something funny to me about a movie like this where, you know, we've seen movies where people try to keep their crimes under wrap, and this guy is just completely bad at it, and just the only way out he sees is just to keep killing as many people as he possibly can. And as the movie went forward, I kept thinking about, you know, this is kind of what George Clooney's Suburbicon could have been if he had laid off the sort of the social material that he was, you know, he was trying to go for, trying to give us greater gravitas, and it kind of stuck with the sort of the Oscar Isaac stuff and some of the darker elements of what Matt Damon's character was up to. And I find this movie far more entertaining than Suburbicon was, because Suburbicon, I thought, was a massive failure, with the exception of the Oscar Isaac stuff. It doesn't entirely work. I mean, it's only about 85 minutes long, and it feels strained at times. Every time he does murder someone, I perked up just because there's something ridiculous going on. And I do make apologies for McBride, because I do find a lot of his antics quite humorous. So I can already tell that I like this movie more than Nick did. I'm not entirely recommending it, but I didn't hate it in the slightest.
All right, we got a break, and when we come back, I'll tell you what I thought of it, and it wasn't what Eric thought of it. So hang on a second. There's Eric and Colin. You guys hang on. We'll take a break. We'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Arizona, and then we got a few more movies to review. It's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, downtown Chicago, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here till 5 a.m. Before the break, Eric told you about a movie called Arizona, and he kind of liked it. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, here's the problem, Eric. I don't like Danny McBride.
Right.
And this is his vehicle. So, I mean, the guy doesn't do it for me at all. I'm really interested to see how Halloween does.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the only thing that it might be the only thing I like that he ever has done. Maybe, because the trailer's pretty great, and I'm hoping for the best on that. And for people who don't know, Danny McBride co-wrote the new Halloween film, and so that's an interesting thing right there. But this is shooting for dark comedy, kind of thing here, and it depends on how much, you know, how much you enjoy Danny McBride, and I don't. So this was torturous for me to sit through. I didn't laugh at all, and there are other really talented people in this movie that are wasted in it, and it never really finds the tone. Like you said, is it really making, you know, some sort of strong commentary on the housing crisis from 10 years ago? No, not really. They're trying to make social comments here, and it doesn't work. So it just resorts to black comedy and Danny McBride doing, like you said, just killing a bunch of people, and it gets more absurd as it goes on. It was only 85 minutes long, but it was a long 85 minutes for me, and it was not good. I watched it on the VOD, and I did not enjoy it. But again, I'm not a Danny McBride fan. People who like Danny McBride probably will enjoy this movie. The guy drives me nuts. I mean,
and I'm not giving it a ringing endorsement. I like a 2.5-star movie for me.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I didn't like it. I'm not really sure why I ended up watching it, because I knew the star was Danny McBride, but I figured I may as well, you know, we got to review it. So there it is. All right. Okay. Colin, why don't you tell us about Juliet Naked?
All right. Well, this is based on a Nick Hornby novel about a guy named Duncan, played by Chris O'Dowd, who has an obsession with this reclusive singer-songwriter named Tucker Crowe, who's played in the movie by Ethan Hawke. And Duncan lives with his girlfriend Annie, played by Rose Byrne, who puts up with this little obsession of his, probably can't take too much more of it. And one day a package shows up in their mailbox and she opens it and it's a CD of a rare recording by Tucker Crowe. And she listens to it first, which causes a rift between her and Duncan. And to add insult to injury, she posts on this Tucker Crowe message board that he moderates and posts on it, you know, rather anonymously, but saying that it's, you know, very dreary and not worth so much praise. And for this, she gets an email from the actual Tucker Crowe saying, you know, you nailed it. And this starts an email relationship between the two of them that eventually blooms into a phone relationship and a real life meetup, all behind Duncan's back, because Duncan eventually cheats on her as well. But Tucker Crowe eventually makes his way to London with his young son in tow. For family reasons, he goes to London, and he decides that, you know, they should meet, and, you know, that's kind of where things take off. And so, like, this was, like I said, based on a Nick Hornby novel, and I know, Nick, you'd agree with this since you adapted one of his novels into a play, High Fidelity.
Yeah.
Hornby's a guy who really knows guys like me and, you know, guys who are obsessed with a particular band or a particular artist or whatever. He's really got their number, or our number, I should say. And so when I'm watching this, and I've read the book, and, you know, I think this movie, I pretty much knew everything that was going to happen in it, but this movie stays fairly close to the book. They made a few changes, but I think it's perfectly cast. I think these are kind of exactly how I pictured these characters. What I was going to say was that, you know, that watching this movie for me, much like when I saw High Fidelity for the first time, kind of felt like, you know, somebody was holding a mirror up to my life and me going, oh, God, I can relate to this. For better or for worse, I can relate to this. I can't imagine actually being obsessed with an artist who isn't making music anymore, unless it's like the Beatles or Elvis, but, you know, someone of that stature. But, okay, I know there's people out there who are like this. And I think the movie has an interesting trick that it has to pull off, which is, you know, whenever there's something in a movie that is supposed to be the best, or, you know, something like in this movie, this character created one of the great rock albums of all time. But, of course, this is fictional. And so, you know, the movie solves this problem of how do we present this music that's supposed to be great. You know, they got a bunch of different singer-songwriters to compose songs for this movie. You know, guys like Robin Hitchcock and M. Ward and Connor Oberst, and some really strong people. So I thought that was a cool way to do it. That's a little minor thing, but I like this movie. I do. I know it's predictable. There's a lot of questions about Tucker's life that go unanswered that, you know, probably could be answered in a better script. But I really like this cast, and I really, you know, you're kind of waiting in this movie for these three characters to be in the same room at the same time, and when that finally happens, it's actually pretty funny. And then, you know, there's also a great scene that I think is pure Nick Hornby, where the fan is confronting the artist and vice versa, and I think the outcome of that scene is really wonderful. So I'm recommending this movie. It's not great. It's a pretty predictable romantic comedy. It's not hard to see where any of this is going, but because of the strength of the cast and because I can relate to a lot of what Nick Hornby is writing about here, I am recommending it.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Colin and Eric are going to hang on when we take a break, and we'll come back after this. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Welcome back. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And we're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here at WGN here till 5 a.m. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on Facebook at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right. It is Monday, and that means the Monday morning movie reviews are happening right now. Before the break, Colin told us about the new romantic comedy, Juliet Naked. And now we'll find out what Eric thought of it. Eric, welcome back.
Hello.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. Eric, tell us what you thought.
Yeah, I'm not recommending this movie. I had several issues with it. Just starting off with just how obnoxious the Chris O'Dowd character is. I mean, I know, you know, we're in the period of toxic masculinity at the moment, but even this guy seemed a little too out there for me to really get a handle on. And then really, it kind of, as much as I like Ethan Hawke in the movie, and I think the movie does turn a bit of a corner once he takes a little bit more of a center stage, particularly in a sequence set in a hospital. I think that, you know, is a scene that's pretty terrific. When the movie focuses on him and his character, and he really sort of brings some life to the story. But my biggest problem with this film is that it's a story that has absolutely no idea what to do with Rose Byrne's character. Rose Byrne's character is, you know, of all the women that we've probably talked about on the show so far, and maybe even upcoming, this is probably the weakest female character written as such that we'll be talking about. She doesn't seem to have any handle on what she exactly wants. She seems like, you know, a ping pong ball between these two characters, even when she's, you know, talking about, you know, what exactly her feelings are, you know, throughout the movie. I never really bought into it. It felt like something that was being written for her rather than something that was being felt in any way by this character. And, and that only sort of increased the sort of the level of the toxic masculinity that these two men, in some ways, you know, are like Svengalis, over her. And it was really disappointing because I'm such a fan of Rose Byrne, and, you know, she doesn't even get much of a chance to do, you know, be a really great comedic presence in this film. She feels like a straight woman for the most part, but not one that is written in, you know, with any clarity throughout. I mean, this movie, like I said, you know, the second half of this movie, when, you know, Ethan's character takes over, just, you know, more proof, you know, what a presence Ethan Hawke, you know, can be in a movie. It's just, I was really disappointed with this one.
Okay. All right. I have not seen it. Juliet Naked, and it's playing in about 5 theaters here in the Chicagoland area. So there you go. All right. Let's see. Eric?
Yeah?
Tell us about the Happy Time Murders.
Okay. Well, this is a film directed by Brian Henson, son of Jim Henson. Contrary to what people might be thinking when they see the trailers, it's not a Muppet movie. It is just a puppet movie, a world where puppets and humans exist in the same world, the same way that toons and humans did in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, the way that food came to life in Sausage Party, and, you know, if you want to throw on Peter Jackson's Meet the Feebles, you got that going for you, too. In this film, which, you know, takes on the appearance of a film noir, a disgraced puppet detective who once worked for the police department, is now working as a PI. His brother was on a television show called The Happy Time Gang, which was the first television show to have puppets and humans interacting. So clearly this is not a world where The Muppet Show ever existed. His ex-partner is played by Melissa McCarthy. They have a strained relationship involving, due to an incident in their past on the force together. And all of a sudden, people from puppets, specifically from the Happy Time Gang, start getting murdered. Phil is around for a number of these murders slowly becomes a suspect himself. Why is someone bumping off all these puppets? What could be the reason for it? And him and McCarthy are reluctantly forced together to solve this crime and mend their fractured partnership. Okay, so I have come to a certain realization about myself that there is just some stupidity in movies that just tickles me the right way. I'm going to preface this review by saying that I'm not fully recommending The Happy Time Murders in the same way that I did not fully recommend Arizona, but I seem to have laughed a lot more than the majority of critics who have seen this movie. I'm not saying anything about them or their sense of humor. This is not them. It is me. And there are a number of things in this movie that made me chuckle and laugh out loud quite a bit. One moment involving a hot tub made me laugh extremely hard. There's an extended bit where Melissa McCarthy and Maya Rudolph get to hang together, and the way that Maya Rudolph pulls out a banana just made me laugh to no end. This is a movie that, you know, when you see the previews, you're seeing R-rated puppets, you know, having sex, saying bad words, getting their heads blown off, all those kinds of things. And yeah, that's a joke that can wear itself pretty thin. And, you know, when I think the movie is not concentrating specifically on that kind of stuff, there is stuff within the cracks here that are worthy of, was worthy of my laughter, I thought. Some of it was silly, some of it I thought was well-timed, some of it I thought was well-delivered. McCarthy has lines in this movie that, I don't know, for some reason, you know, if they were in, any of those, the other, you know, some of the Paul Feig movies or some of the Apatow movies that she's been in, that I think that would have gotten bigger laughs. They wouldn't have been written off as much. And I will certainly take this movie over any of the movies she's made with her husband Ben Falcone. That's Tammy and the Boss and Life of the Party. I think this is funnier than all of those movies combined. It doesn't entirely come together. The screenplay is kind of all over the place. It doesn't quite have a grasp on what it wants to do with the puppets and their physiology, and it relies a little too much on some of the physical humor involved with them, but damn it, there's stuff in this movie that made me laugh, and do I have to apologize for it? I don't know, but there it is.
All right. Colin, what did you think?
Well, I wouldn't have to apologize. No, I wouldn't. I don't think you have to apologize for it, although I completely disagree. I tried. I really tried. I wanted this thing to be funny, and I just, the longer it went on, the more I realized that it was just coasting on another movie that's coasting on an idea of it's funny because they're puppets. And really, you can only get by on that for so long. Puppets being vulgar and, you know, killing each other and having sex. It's not edgy. It's actually kind of tiresome by now because, as Eric mentioned, we already had Meet the Feebles. And let's not forget Crank Yankers either, which was a very funny show. And that's funny because they're puppets, but also because they had great writers and people saying funny things. But this movie needed great writers. It needed people who really knew what was funny. And, you know, just wasn't just getting by solely on attitude that we've seen before. You know, I would have loved to have seen something along the lines of Meet the Feebles had a great sequence that was a parody of The Deer Hunter. You know, like something like that this movie could have done. Instead, it goes this, like, really tired film noir route. You know, it basically wants to do Roger Rabbit's, what Roger Rabbit did, but doesn't have nearly the wit or even the chutzpah of that film.
It's making me crazy that Roger Rabbit has been brought up like three times now.
I know.
Movie. And I understand why, yeah. Because it's, you know, they're coexisting and it is film noir, but man, to put this movie in the same sentence as Roger Rabbit, I don't know.
Oh, normally, that's it though. I mean, if it wasn't for just if it wasn't even just for the film noir thing, I wouldn't even be, would be bringing up Roger Rabbit. It's just, that's just what it is.
Yeah.
I'll take Life of the Party over this. I actually laughed more during that movie than this one. I wanted to like it. It wasn't letting me like it.
Okay. So. All right, guys, hang on, and I'll tell you what I thought of The Happy Time Murders, and that'll be coming up right after we take this break, and then Eric and I will talk about the box office as well, which we do every Monday morning. All right, we'll take a break. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Hey, how you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Before the break, Colin and Eric both reviewed the Happy Time Murders. Eric liked it more than Colin. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, I hated it. I think I laughed twice, not very hard, and I laughed at. I thought Maya Rudolph was, you know, I thought Maya Rudolph was kind of amusing throughout the, you know, whatever her scenes were. And I thought the one time that I laughed was when, or the one time that I laughed kind of out loud was when the filth puppet thing and Melissa McCarthy were going, he was going through the back door, she was going through the front door, and they're trying to hear each other as they're talking.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about? I can't read your lips, you're a puppet.
Right.
That part, that exchange is the only time I laughed out loud during the entire thing. And also, I will say this, the other big laugh for me was, oddly enough, Ben Falcone's little appearance.
Yes.
And what she says to him as she's leaving, that cracked me up too. But that's it. Other than that, I was tired of this movie. I mean, 10 minutes in, I was like, "Oh God, this is just gonna be." And it's repetitive, and it's over and over and over and over again. And the whole noir thing, there's nothing new about it. They didn't try anything. All the voiceover stuff and all that. The attempt to make some sort of commentary about how the puppets were treated. I don't know if that, you know what I mean? Like, because there's like puppetism, I guess. like Joel McHale is in this movie for nothing, really. What it was trying to do there seemed unfocused. And it just got to the part where it was like, okay, you know, all right. Bodily fluids flying out of a puppet for 5 minutes. That joke was over 10 seconds into that joke. And it goes on forever. All the stuff. And then like the outtakes at the end where everybody seems to be laughing their asses off on the set. Like, these guys are having a great time making this movie. Too bad it's terrible. And I was looking forward to this, you know, I really was. And I love the fact that, you know, I loved the idea that Jim Henson's son was going to, you know, make this movie. And I thought, wow, that's really pretty cool. But this is just base stuff. And it's one joke over and over and over and over and over again. And I did not laugh. I mean, like I said, I laughed twice throughout the entire thing. And it just seemed endless. And it's just like less than 90 minutes. And it feels like 5 hours long. So, the Happy Time Murders, I hated it. I hate it.
I guess I'm just a simple creature amused by funny-looking puppets.
I guess, man.
The strung-out puppet made me laugh.
The strung-out puppet did?
Yeah.
Okay.
That whole conversation that Melissa McCarthy has with the strung-out puppet.
Yeah. I don't know, man. Didn't do it for me at all.
Okay.
Didn't do it for me at all. And you're talking to a guy, you know, Meet the Feebles, I think, is great. We didn't mention, you know, it's not, they were different kind of puppets, but Team America, brilliantly funny and
much, much better film.
And just sharp as hell. It's Trey Parker. So, you know, that means it's going to be funny and witty and smart,
right.
And of all of which the Happy Time Murders is not. So, oh boy. All right. So there we go. We are off next week for Labor Day.
So
we will not be reviewing movies for Labor Day next week. But what's coming out next week? Operation Finale, I know, is...
Operation Finale, Kin comes out.
Oh, yeah.
Searching is coming out with John Cho.
Right.
And also, opening the facets is King Cohen, which is a documentary about Larry Cohen.
Oh, right.
Which is terrific.
Yes. Okay, very cool. All right, well, we have the week off next week, guys. So have a good, Colin, have a good couple of weeks. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Good.
And there you go. All right, Eric, let's talk a little box office here.
Yeah.
Boy, there's Crazy Rich Asians, man. $25 million in its second week.
Yeah, an estimated 5.7% drop in its second week.
Wow.
The biggest drop that I could find from a wide release this year was Book Club.
Mm.
And that was like 25.8%. So 20% lower drop than the best drop of the year so far.
That's amazing.
Yeah, boy, this is actually ahead of the pace of both We're the Millers and The Help, and those movies grossed $150 and $169 million respectively.
Wow.
So this thing has got chance, you know, to go through the roof. And, I mean, next, there's no reason to believe it's not going to be number one next weekend.
Yeah.
With Labor Day weekend.
Yep.
And it'll be beat by The Nun the following week. So Warner Brothers will take number one again.
Yeah.
They have the Meg. They're going to have 3 weeks of Crazy Rich Asians. They're going to own the box office for at least five straight weeks.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
All right. Well, so it's up to $76.8 million in just America alone. Crazy
yeah.
Rich Asians. And obviously, has it opened in Asia?
No, it hasn't. It's only gotten only a couple markets on the foreign. It's only made like $7 million so far. That'll change eventually.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the movie is already, but it's only cost like $35 million, maybe $30 million. So it's already going to be in profit just with America's dollars.
That's amazing. Wow,
yeah.
That's a real success story right there.
Really?
All right. Number two, The Meg, $13 million, $105 million in America. Now, we were talking about this last week. These are good numbers, but they spent a lot of money on this movie.
Yeah, yeah. And again, with the conservative numbers, I mean, this movie's over $400 million worldwide. It's doing tremendous business overseas, tremendous business. But this is a movie that's going to need about $560 million to break even. That's how much they spent on this thing. And it's really, I mean, and it's really boggles me because the money is not on the screen.
I agree.
Did they spend all this money?
Yeah, I agree.
For this movie. So, yeah.
All right. Number three, Happy Time Murders, $10 million. That was less than what people expected, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone was, you know, I mean, we think we talked about it last week that, and I think I said this movie, you know, could do $20 million or could do less than $10 million.
Right.
You know, it could go either way, and it almost did less than $10 million.
Yeah.
I mean, it cost $40 million. This movie, you know, they've been trying to make this movie for about 10 years, and it's not. I mean, there's nothing good to take away from this number. Nothing.
Wow, $40 million it cost.
Yeah.
Good God. All right.
Yeah.
all right. Number four, Mission Impossible Fallout, $8 million. Its total is $193.9 million, and that's just in America. Hit.
Yeah, $538 million worldwide, and it is still not opened in China.
Wow.
So that's coming.
Oh, man.
That's coming next week.
All right. Number five, Christopher Robin, $6.3 million, $77.6 million total.
Yeah, doing okay. Still kind of just, you know, eking out, you know, getting close to $100 million.
Mm-hmm. All right. Number six is Mile 22, which is the Mark Wahlberg, Peter Berg movie.
Yeah, big drop, 56% drop, second week in a row. I mean, STX released both that and Happy Time Murders, and I mean both of those movies. I mean, Mile 22 cost $50 million. Not expecting big numbers internationally. That studio is probably going to be looking to put up another Bad Moms movie as soon as they can.
Okay. Alpha number seven, $5.6 million. Number eight, Black Klansman with $5.3 million. Number nine, Axel with $2.9 million.
The ongoing struggle of Global Roads, formerly known as Open Road, that they still haven't opened a movie to $10 million since Nightcrawler in 2014.
Wow. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then number 10 is Slender Man, $2.7 million, $25.4 million total, but didn't cost anything to make, right?
Right, right. And those Black Klansman numbers are still, I mean, they, Focus expanded the movie into like another 200 theaters this weekend. It's definitely going to be Spike's third highest grossing movie of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably going to sneak in. It's going to be like in the top 15 movies that Focus has ever released as well.
There
so that's a nice story going on right there.
They're great. Okay, well, cool. There's the box office, our movie reviews. We're taking a week off. Have a great Labor Day weekend, Eric, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good.
All right, we'll take a break here on 720 WGN.